You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and we're here today to discuss Afghanistan, as you know. In one sense, it's still a hopeful time of year. The Redskins haven't lost their first game yet, and the Nationals are still in first place, and so we're all hopeful. On the other hand, 15 years into the Afghanistan mission and 15 years after 9/11, we know that there is an ongoing, very difficult struggle throughout the broader Middle East, and certainly not least within Afghanistan itself. And we're glad that you came to join us in this discussion. I know there are a couple of words of introduction I want to say before introducing the panelists. By the way, the basic approach we'll take here is to have a broad question framed by me to each of them and then get a few basic ideas on the table. We'll talk amidst ourselves for a bit, and then about halfway through, we'll go to you for your questions. First, I know we all, not just on the panel but in the room, want to commemorate and mourn the victims of 9/11, the families, the soldiers, airmen, Marines, and sailors, and everyone else in the intelligence community elsewhere who have worked so hard, often at great sacrifice, sometimes being hurt along the way, their families, their communities. It's just a day and a moment to reflect and to honor them since we are again approaching 9/11, and I know this is on all of our minds. Second, in the same vein of commemorating big events, I want to thank my colleague Gail Chaliff, who has been our communications director in the Foreign Policy Program for almost a decade, is leaving Brookings after today. And we collected a few of the little statistics that give some small indication to the extent you can ever use metrics, whether in counterinsurgency or in think tankdom, to assess progress. In her time at Brookings, on her watch, the monthly web hits for the Foreign Policy Program have more than tripled. She has organized or helped organize some 1,500 events like this one, and she has supervised and orchestrated some 5,000 television or radio spots by her various scholars over that period of time, and she's going off to work on the important issue of refugees in the future, and we greatly respect her commitment to public policy and to her fellow human being and what she's done for all of us. I want to thank her and her team that have worked with her so closely over the years. Big day for us at Brookings, so thank you for giving me a chance to mention that. Now let me please... As you know, we have outstanding talent on this panel. I want to say a brief word about each of my colleagues. It's really a treat to be able to not only honor Gail, but to recognize who we've got up here. Just to my left, Vonda Felbad-Brown, one of the most diligent and intrepid and brilliant field researchers that I've ever met, and been going to Afghanistan for, I think, over a decade now, going back to her dissertation days, wrote a book called Shooting Up, which talked about Afghanistan and as one of her main case studies on the nexus between counterinsurgency and counter-narcotic strategies, which, of course, remains a big issue there to this day, continues to travel often to Afghanistan, and wrote one of the best books on the subject, Aspiration and Ambivalence, which I recommend to anyone who hasn't yet read it. Really gets at a lot of the difficult period of the last 15 years in the U.S.-led mission there. And speaking of that mission, next to her is General John Allen, who, as you know, is a Brookings Senior Fellow. He was the commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan from the summer of 2011 into the winter of 2013, a 19-month stretch, which was crucial. Before I get back to that and say one or two more words about that tenure, however, I want to let you all know that this is a lifelong Marine who did a lot of other things in the Marine Corps, beginning with helping create the fabled Infantry Officer Course at Quantico, which is really the signature event for training officers in infantry in the U.S. Marine Corps, which did not exist in the current form prior to his role in that, I think, as a major back in the 1990s. We know the Marines trusted him. The real impressive thing to me is that the Navy then trusted him, and they gave him, admittedly, he was a graduate of Annapolis himself, but they gave him the job of Commandant of the Midshipmen at the U.S. Naval Academy, the first time a Marine was ever asked to be responsible for sailors in that institution, in that capacity. And that just tells you something about how much the Navy, like all of us, had high regard for General Allen. He then spent his one-star appointment or period of time working on East Asia issues at the Pentagon in the early 2000s before deploying with the Marines to Al-Anbar province and being one of our two or three key Marines in the Anbar Awakening and the Surge. And then from that point on, many other jobs in the Central Command theater, including being David Petraeus's deputy at Central Command, being the acting commander there for a while, and ultimately stepping down from government last fall in a civilian role as the coordinator for the president and Secretary Kerry in the campaign against ISIS. And so in Afghanistan, as many of you know, let me just say one word to situate in the debate. In Afghanistan, he was there during the initial downsizing. And I think he commented once or twice to his friend General Petraeus that, by comparison, Petraeus had it easy because he was there when the forces were coming up. And then as soon as they peaked, General Petraeus left, and General Allen was asked to start implementing the drawdown. But the good news for today's discussion for all of us is that that meant that General Allen was involved in transferring responsibility to the Afghan security forces, which, of course, is in many ways the main issue for security today because that's the main fighting force at a time when the United States has downsized by 90% and we're down to roughly 10,000 U.S. military personnel in country. Bruce Rydell was asked by President Obama to coordinate the initial 2009 policy review on Afghanistan-Pakistan, a role that he played along with Richard Holbrooke and Michelle Flournoy, and they produced the initial Obama thinking on what to do about the entire region. And that was after a number of years he had spent already at Brookings, where he is also a senior fellow today. He was a 30-year veteran of the CIA, also on secondment numerous times to the National Security Council, where he played a key role in things such as diffusing Indo-Pakistani crises in the late 1990s, among other roles. Also very involved in the Middle East peace process, which John Allen was as well. And Bruce, in his time here, has written at least two very well-received books related to the Pakistan question, one of them called Deadly Embrace and the other Avoiding Armageddon. And so that sets him up extremely well to help us understand Pakistan's role in the ongoing Afghanistan theater. Thank you for your indulgence. I wanted to do proper justice to framing the issue, to thanking colleagues, and to setting the stage. And so now I'm finally going to pose a question. We'll start with General Allen, then go to Vonda and Bruce. And what I want to ask General Allen is just for his overall take on the security situation. Before I give him the baton, I'm going to also let you know that in a minute here, I'm going to ask our newly arrived Army colonel. We have a very good fortune of having military and intelligence Coast Guard fellows here each year, active duty officers who or analysts who are going back to their agency but are spending a year with us. Colonel J.B. Vowell was the senior American mentoring and advising the Afghan 201st and 203rd Corps in the eastern part of the country until last fall. And he certainly stayed in very close touch with those Corps headquarters since that time. So he can give us a fairly real-time update. And I'll call on him at some point in the discussion from the front row to share his thoughts. But first, we'll get started. So General Allen, again, thank you for your service in what you did in Afghanistan. And I wondered, now looking back 3 years later, but I know you're tracking it still carefully, on a day when there have been numerous, acts of violence and explosions in Afghanistan just today, how you see the situation, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly, how do you feel about the prognostication of the path going forward as well?
Well, it's great to be back on the panel here with you, Mike. This is a very important subject, obviously. Coming up on the 15th anniversary, I was the deputy commandant at the Naval Academy, then became the commandant shortly thereafter, the day we were attacked on 9/11, so I remember it very well. I remember being with those midshipmen that day as they were trying to figure out where life was going to take them, and I knew where life was going to take them, and I knew where life was going to take me. 10 years later to the day, I would be commanding the war effort in Afghanistan, and I has said before that you can depart Afghanistan, but you can never really leave it. And so from that moment where I took command in July of 2011 to today, it's been a very special place to me. And as we come up on the 15th anniversary here in a couple of days, I'll take a moment and recall all of our troops and the Allied troops who've perished in this, but very importantly, to recall the sacrifices of the Afghan forces. Enormous sacrifices of the Afghan forces and the sacrifice of the Afghan civilians as well in this conflict. We said before on this stage and many other places that the success, the long-term success of Afghanistan, whether it's a political success or an economic success or whether it can join in credible ways the community of nations, is going to be a function of the security environment and the capacity of the Afghan National Security Forces to provide that security over a long time. We can go back and do the forensics and the post-mortem, et cetera, on all the recommendations that had been made on numbers and how those numbers ultimately were implemented and where they are. And I will finish my remarks about where we are today with the numbers, because numbers don't really tell the story. But we have, in the aftermath of the departure of ISAF and the closing down of that mission and the establishment of the NATO mission called Resolute Support, we've had about 13,000 NATO forces in theater. 9,500 or so have been U.S. at this point for some period of time. Of that number, about 2,800 or so are special operators, and the rest are trainers and advisors. Situation on the ground in Afghanistan has changed from time to time, and today there's a lot of debate about how you would articulate the situation on the ground. I would definitely use the term challenging. The situation has, in fact, become more challenging, perhaps even worrisome, in the last several months, over the last year. And it's not something which I think will be beyond the capacity of the Afghan forces to hold over time and to deal with over time. Having been very close to those forces for a better part of a year and a half, having seen Afghan troops in combat, having seen many of their leaders lead their troops credibly, not just at the small unit level, but increasingly at the larger unit level, brigade size operations, regular brigade size operations, I do, and I still have, confidence that the Afghan National Security Forces can pull this out over time. That said, we have seen the Taliban resurgence be problematic in the last year or so. The Taliban in the north have become a challenge. We had that brief moment in Kunduz, near humiliation, frankly, for the Afghan National Security Forces, but ultimately they were able to take back Kunduz, but at not an insignificant human price. And then, of course, we had the disaster of the friendly fire on the hospital there, for which we all still regret those casualties. And we've also seen a resurgence in Afghan Taliban activity in the Helmand province as well, a loss of a number of the districts, which has forced both the American commander in conjunction with the Afghan leadership to put additional American forces on the ground in the Helmand province to at least hold the district capital of Lashkargah. I do believe, however, that we'll see that negative trend reversed, largely because, in fact, the leadership in the 215th Corps, which is the corps that sits upon that particular area, Helmand just west of Kandahar, has been replaced, and I think we're going to see some improvement in the relatively near future. The previous commander was largely incompetent. I think the challenge that we face going ahead will be the stabilizing of our numbers for the long period of time to continue to affect the kind of relationship that we need to have with the Afghans, not just in a training role but an advisory role, to include now providing additional air support to the Afghan National Security Forces, in particular the Afghan Army, in ways we were unable to do before. That, I think, is going to be of a lot of assistance to us to secure the environment, maintain control of the population centers, not to give up any more of the districts. At this point, a number of districts have gone into the hands of the Taliban more than we would certainly want, but I do believe that over time they'll be able to take them back. Let me talk briefly about the U.S. Decision-making. You know, the numbers that we had originally recommended and ultimately were put on the ground varied by some extent, to some extent. As I said, it's history. We went in with 9,500 or so and another 3,000 or so non-U.S. NATO troops. That number was both probably too small and too short a period of time in terms of the initial obligation to those forces. As late as June of this year, all of the former Afghan the former American commanders in Afghanistan and all the former American ambassadors to Afghanistan wrote an open letter to the president asking that we cease all drawdown of American forces in Afghanistan until such time as the new president, after this election, can have the time to study the situation to determine whether additional drawdown requirements should be met, whether we should stabilize for some period of time, whether we should even go up in numbers. And my conversations, which continue with our allied partners, many of our allied partners who are still on the ground, there's about 40 U.S. And other partners on the ground today in resolute support, whether in fact we need to go up in numbers over time. But the bottom line for us was in June of this year, we asked that we stop the drawdown to permit the next president, whoever that's going to be, who will own the outcome in Afghanistan, the opportunity to thoroughly study the relationship between the security environment, the political environment, and the economic environment, because they're all inextricably linked. Study the relationship between the three of those to determine whether the NATO commitment is satisfactory both in numbers and in capabilities and in timeline to support the continued training and operational capabilities of the Afghan National Security Forces over an extended period. And we'll see papers coming out of Brookings that continue to be a result of the combined efforts of the generals and the ambassadors and scholars who are attentive to this. So the security environment is essential as the platform for going forward both politically and economically. That security platform is definitely challenged today. I don't believe the Afghan National Security Forces are losing, but I do believe that a resurgent Taliban, believing that in fact we were going down to a number which could permit them to effect a tipping point on the with the Afghans, I believe that we have foiled that plan. And by staying at the number that we are today, which will be somewhere around 8,500, and even with the next president conceivably going up in a number or changing our capabilities mix or increasing our firepower in support of the Afghan National Security Forces, I believe we'll hold what we've got, we'll change the momentum, and I am, as I always am, Mike, I am pragmatic on the subject. I'm not optimistic or pessimistic. I'm pragmatic on the subject. And if we get our decision-making right and the Afghans are sufficiently discriminating in who they permit to lead the various corps, and I think, Colonel Val, where are you there? Good to see you. 201st, 203rd Corps have always been pretty strong. They're in the east and in the northeast. It's where the biggest fight is. That's a pretty good outfit. 205th Corps, which is the Kandahar region, has typically had a very strong commander. The 215th Corps, which is the Helmand area, and if you will, the heart and soul of the Taliban, that has always been problematic. It's always been a tough fight. Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah have fired more than 70 general officers from the Afghan National Security Forces and the police. That's a good start, but we've got a lot more to do, and until leadership and command in Afghanistan truly is determined on meritocracy and not patronage, we're going to have this challenge. And it's not uncommon for that part of the world to have that challenge. We just need to recognize it. And we recognize it by stabilizing our numbers, stabilizing our appearance, ensuring our capabilities are the best suited for the needs of the Afghan National Security Forces. And I think we'll be okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, General Allen. And Vonda, I know that I wanted to ask you about politics and economics, and I will in a second, but because the security situation is so paramount and it's on our minds today with the recent attacks, I want to just give you a second to comment on how you see things there as well, because it's obviously a complex mosaic. There's a lot of good and a lot of bad. I just wanted to ask you to add your perspective.
Well, thank you, Mike, and good morning. I would underscore General Allen's comment that the security is challenging. I might add, very challenging, probably most challenging that it has been any time since 2002. And certainly challenging from the perspective of the Afghan people, but also from the perspective of international civilians who operate in the country and very much enable or assist in delivering governance as well as economic growth. Afghanistan has become very unpermissive and difficult environment, with few people who live in Kabul being able to travel out of Kabul. And it is not just the internationals. It is also Afghans. Just traveling between Jalalabad and Kabul is a major risk. going up north, not just to Kunduz, but to Bahlan, has become essentially unpermissible for many Afghans. And so what we see today is a government that is in deep ways, and a core community that is in deep ways cut out or cut off from large parts of the country. The level of civilian casualties is the greatest that it has ever been. Now, none of this means that it cannot be reversed, but nonetheless, the security situation deeply impinges and at this point undermines or outright eviscerates many elements of economic development and many elements of governance, and creates very much a state of siege and profound insecurity mentality in the country. I've been communicating intensely with friends in Kabul over the past 24 hours, and it's been quite disturbing to see their reactions to the series of attacks. They're not surprising, and my thoughts are very much with them. But just the level of going about everyday issues that has been at the core of challenges and problems for Afghans in many rural areas is becoming a major issue for people in cities. And of course, those difficult security situations is not just about the Taliban and for that matter, IS, Khorasan in some parts of the country. But it's also very much about criminality and politics. Indeed, a very significant element of insecurity hampering daily life and something that the Taliban can plug into and exploit is the level of kidnapping that's going on in the country by many criminal networks, some deeply connected to powerful patronage networks and powerful politicians. Those target internationals, but they very much target also Afghan businessmen. And in fact, what we are probably seeing is something that at one point happened in Colombia at the height of the crisis, when the numbers of people who were targeted for kidnapping, or the type of people targeted for kidnapping, was going down from simply very rich businessmen to quite middle-class people would be vulnerable. And that, again, compounded the deep sense of insecurity and paralysis of everyday life. And so it's very important and very imperative that the government takes on these kidnapping networks, takes on the pervasive criminality that is both an in for the Taliban, but also crucially debilitates everyday life. And I started saying that this is, of course, all linked to politics, and we are at the moment of interesting and challenging situation in Afghanistan. The initial configuration of the current Afghan government with President Ghani and CEO Abdullah was to last 2 years. And then there was to be a reconsideration of that arrangement. At various points in various formulation, President Ghani and Dr. Abdullah believed there would be parliamentary and district elections held, and perhaps some more longer-term resolution of the relationship. That has not happened. There have not been parliamentary elections, there have not been district elections, and electoral reform has been stuck for over a year. And so there are now voices saying that the government should come to an end, there is no longer a space for Dr. Abdullah in his CEO roles. His view was that by now he would be appointed prime minister and the system would be changed to a parliamentary system. That was not necessarily something that President Ghani ever bought into. So there were very different initial understandings of what would happen in the 2 years to start with. And they are now being compounded by many voices outside the government, with former President Karzai having repeatedly called for a loya jirga to give new legitimacy to the government, that jirga would be unconstitutional and many fear would not be helpful to the political process. So we are in this state of watching for the next few weeks how that disagreement will be resolved and whether the government will stay in this current constellation or whether there will be changes. Certainly, there cannot be a constitutional jirga held, and there will not be elections probably for at least half a year, likely more than that. And meanwhile, there are other politics in Kabul and outside of Kabul, relations between President Ghani and the government and several governors, some of whom he tried to fire but had not been able to accomplish that. Others on whose loyalties he crucially depends, but where he has tensions and an uneasy relationship. And that some of these tensions gave way on Friday to actual firefight between supporters of Vice President Dostum and a northern Tajik group. And I raise that because although it had no sort of lasting impact on the stability of the government or on how security develops in Afghanistan, but at the same time, the firefight again stimulated in Afghanistan a sense that this might be a preview of much deeper disintegration and much deeper political unraveling of the country. And it raised fears and memories of the 1990s. And I believe that there is an opportunity in all these difficult elements for the Afghan government, and in fact, for Afghan politicians and Afghan people. For too long, there was a sense among many Afghan politicians that they can conduct governance by rocking the ship of state as much as possible to milk greater political appointments and other forms of payoffs, and that politics can be about constant brinksmanship and crisis making. Well, Afghanistan cannot afford that anymore. Politics has to be about governance that secures people, and about governance that improves their lives. And for a very long time, Afghan politicians would say it can never disintegrate into the 1990s. It can never go back to the civil war. Well, maybe that firefight is a wake-up call that their mode of politics needs to fundamentally change. And that once the government gets out of the current crisis, whether this is later in this month or in October or even later than that, and there is a new government, that this new government has an opportunity to work with other political power brokers, other politicians, to actually start delivering governance in a more robust way and less corrupt way than has been the case so far.
Thank you. I'm half tempted to ask if you think the state of Afghan politics is better or worse than ours, but I'll leave that one. I'll come back to you in a little bit on some of the specific questions on my mind about Afghan politics and also the economy, but I'll get Bruce here engaged as well and just ask, Bruce, your take on especially the Pakistan angle, anything you want to talk about, of course, but I know that when you did your policy review for President Obama 7.5 years ago, you had certain understanding of Pakistan, a lot of history in dealing with it, probably certain assumptions about how things would evolve. I'd be curious if things have gone more or less as you expected, and if not, how does that change the calculus here? How much is the Pakistani role in this conflict, the central determinant, as some would allege, how much is it more of a secondary factor?
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for organizing this, and it's a pleasure to be here with John and Vanda and all of you. I'm going to come to the specifics you mentioned, but let me start with, I think, a piece of good news, which is going to be rare today. When President Obama announced his strategy in March of 2009, he was very clear about what the top goal and priority of American policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan was, and that was what we call the three Ds: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In 2009, that meant primarily in Pakistan. The 2001 American intervention in Afghanistan essentially moved al-Qaeda from one side of the Durand Line to the other side of the Durand Line. By 2008, 2009, the al-Qaeda core in Pakistan was robust, fully recovered from the 2001 intervention, and engaged in a global terrorist operation. Remember, in 2000, 2003, we had the Madrid attack, the deadliest terrorist attack in Western Europe since the beginning of the 9/11 era. We had the London attack in 2005. We foiled an attack by al-Qaeda in 2006 to simultaneously blow up 7 jumbo jets over the Atlantic coming out of Heathrow. Imagine what that would have done to the global economy in 2006. We now know that in 2009, al-Qaeda was planning a massive attack on the New York City subway system, which was fortunately foiled largely due to the National Security Agency. Al-Qaeda, in short, was the proper goal of the United States in 2009. 7.5 years later, al-Qaeda in Pakistan is not destroyed, but it has been substantially degraded and substantially put on the back foot. It requires continued monitoring, it requires continued surveillance, but the situation today is much improved over what it was in 2008, 2009, when President Obama campaigned and then came into office. I think there are significant lessons learned to be learned from that episode. One of them is that the United States has to be offensive as well as defensive in how it thinks about the problems in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I would characterize our strategy in Afghanistan for the last 15 years as largely defensive. We have been trying to shore up the Afghan government, to shore up the Afghan national security forces. That's difficult to do when you basically cede to the opposition, to the Afghan Taliban, that they will have an open and permanent sanctuary next door in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. The Afghan Taliban, for at least 14 of the last 15 years, has been able to operate not with impunity in Pakistan, but with the patronship of the Pakistani army. This goes beyond simply providing a sanctuary and safe haven for the leadership of the Afghan Taliban and their families. This goes to active patronage and support. We know that the Pakistani army, and particularly Pakistani intelligence services, actively engaged in training the Afghan Taliban, in helping them fund their operations, and in planning attacks, including attacks inside Kabul. I think we have to learn some lessons about this as the next president starts thinking about where to go forward. In May of this year, President Obama authorized what has so far been a one-off, a drone operation against the Afghan Taliban leadership, in particular in this case, the head of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Mansour, in Baluchistan. We'd never had a drone operation before, at least a drone operation with the actual use of a missile in Baluchistan before. That mission is very controversial. You will hear people on different sides say it killed the peace process, and you will hear people on other sides say there was no peace process to kill. There was a terrorist leader to go after. I think it should become a model. I think the next president ought to consider this and look back on how we have progressed against al-Qaeda in thinking about how we progress against Afghanistan, Afghan Taliban. By that, I mean we ought to be thinking about carrying out operations like the operation against Mullah Mansour in Baluchistan and in other parts of Pakistan in the future. We do not need to have the tempo of operations that we had against al-Qaeda in Pakistan. We're not going to destroy the Afghan Taliban through drone operations, nor should we try to. But we should try to disrupt and to seriously dismantle the sanctuaries and the safe havens. In essence, we ought to take the safety out of the safe havens. I think that's one recommendation I would make to the next president. The second would also be an offensive operation, and Mullah Mansour provides a good starting point for talking about that. Mullah Mansour's passport was recovered by the Pakistani press after he was killed in that drone operation. It was a Pakistani passport provided to him by the Pakistani army. It was in a false name. Inside, it showed that he had made 18 trips from Karachi to Dubai over the course of the last 5 years, and several other trips to Manama in Bahrain and probably to other Gulf states. What was the purpose of 18 trips to Dubai? The Afghan Taliban has told us, fundraising. He was going to Dubai for repeated moves for fundraising. Some of the fundraising is in drug smuggling. The biggest part of the fundraising, though, is in raising funds from sympathetic audiences in the Gulf states. I think we need to target that as well. I think we need an aggressive move by the Department of Treasury, working with our Gulf state partners to prevent that kind of fundraising from continuing in the future. Again, we're not going to stop at 100%. We're not going to destroy the Afghan Taliban through that. But we should bring about a situation in which Afghan Taliban fundraising is as difficult to do today as Al-Qaeda fundraising is difficult to do in Gulf states today. We've had significant progress over 15 years in persuading the Saudis, the UAE, and others to get out of the business of letting their private individuals support Al-Qaeda. We've had progress on the Islamic State. We need to do the same thing with the Afghan Taliban. We, of course, have other objectives and goals in Pakistan as well. One of the most important is to support the entrenchment of Pakistani democracy. And here I think I also would say that there's good news 7 years after, 15 years after September 11th. Pakistan today has a thriving free press. It's not always a responsible free press, but it's certainly a thriving free press. I am reminded of your question about whether their free press is as responsible as our free press, Mike, but we'll leave that question to others to think about. We've also seen in Pakistan in the last few years the transition from one democratically elected government to another democratically elected government. That is a milestone in the history of Pakistan democracy that shouldn't be overlooked. We've also seen Pakistan seriously address the problem of its own Taliban, the Pakistan Taliban, and go after it in a way which we have never seen before. Pakistan today is a unique country. It is a country that is a victim of terrorism. There are horrendous acts of terrorism being carried out in Pakistan nearly every day. Unfortunately, the Pakistani army continues to be a patron of terrorism in other parts of the world, and particularly patron of the Afghan Taliban. And that calculation was going to be difficult to do, but I think that's one of the priorities that the next president is going to have to focus on when he or she thinks about what to do with the Afghan-Pakistan situation.
Thank you. I'm going to go down the row, and I have a question for each of you. But before I do that, I think I will go to Colonel Vowell. And let me just, by way of asking him for 2 or 3 minutes of comments on what he saw with the Afghan forces, just for those of you who don't study this thing full time, let me remind you of the different numbers we're talking about, and people can correct me if I get one wrong. But basically, the Afghan army is organized into 6 main corps. And these each have a geographic zone. And you can sort of imagine doing a clockwise circle in your head and starting up in the northeast, so along the Pakistan border, in the very mountainous zone, Kunar region, et cetera, is the 201st Corps. Then we come down southward to the 203rd, over to Kandahar in the 205th. Helmand was added as a separate corps later, so it got its own sort of out-of-sequence numbering of 215. And then there's 207 and 209 coming back around. And so Colonel Vowell was the lead U.S. mentor in a team of, I think, several hundred Americans deployed to Jalalabad, if I have it right, and he'll correct whatever I get wrong here in just a second, through last fall. And these were the largest formations the United States still had deployed in the field, if you will. Most of the other formations were either these counterterrorism teams that would be available on demand, or central training teams in Kabul, or intelligence and other kind of institution-building mentors in the capital city and in other major cities. So Colonel Vowell was essentially in the most forward of the kind of units the United States still has in Afghanistan today, and that's what makes up this 10,000-strong force that General Allen was mentioning, which is a total of close to 15,000 if you add all the rest of our NATO partners and other countries as well. So with that as quick background, I want to see if Colonel Vowell would like to add to the discussion with his sense of both the security situation in the East and also the progress of the Afghan army. Sir.
Thanks,
please,
Mike.
Feel free to stand up if you like. It's whatever's convenient.
Sure. I'll go ahead and sit down if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Don't want to obstruct the views for people for the panel. As Mike mentioned, I'm an infantry officer. I've been an infantry officer in the Army for 25 years, and I'll give you a perspective having been in 3 combat deployments in Afghanistan in the past 12 years. So from some of the early days to middle during the surge in 2010-11 to where I left the country in October of last year, all different missions. And that informed my perspective that I would call rationally optimistic about the Afghan National Security Forces and the government in Afghanistan, much to what General Allen already alluded to. This is also my first day at Brookings as a federal executive fellow with my peers, so hopefully
welcome aboard.
Hopefully, we won't be graded too harshly. So, Afghanistan is hard, and it's hard all the time. For all of those things that the panel has mentioned, the human terrain, the physical geography, issues of social and cultural change, endemic corruption, illicit trade, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be more than just the graveyard of empires. It's that crossroad of conquest, and for things that change have to happen over very long periods of time. And so evolutionary change is my perspective in the last 12 years. I'll just keep the comments focused upon when I was an infantry task force commander in Kunar during the surge, and then my brigade command experience last year. Different missions. In 2010, we were there to partner with the Afghan security forces in a counterinsurgency to help the government reach and extend its nascent reach to the people at the provincial and district level, and also to help provide efficient and effective fighting forces in the field with our effort as a model on missions and operations throughout the country. A lot of experiences during that surge, very kinetic, very heavy. Our initial main effort to work with district and local governance were the main effort where the people contacted their government, took a lot of effort. It's not 3 cups of tea in that country, it's 3 gallons of tea. And that discussion and dialogue was very important. I learned a couple of lessons that year, some of which I'll describe here. One, there's no better instrument for counterinsurgency in that country than their own Afghan National Security Forces. In the meetings with governors, district governors, political officials, military officials, the Afghan security forces could lead that discussion, could participate in that discussion in a supportive role to their elective government. That was impressive. A lot of problem solving that happens between the security forces and their government without coalition intervention. That was pretty good. However, during that year, I noticed the particularly troubling problem that without coalition involvement, without coalition partnership, without coalition enabling capabilities, Afghan National Security Forces were very troubled, were very hard to get in the field and fight. And so I left that combat deployment in 2011 with kind of a, you can't want it more than they do. They have to have the leadership, they have to have the systems, they have to have the support, but there's going to be a requirement for security forces to plan, prepare, execute, assess their operations, recover from those, and transition to their next campaign. I left thinking that would never happen. We spent a long time in Western Europe, a long time in the Far East after World War II, helping to develop and build those countries. If any model like that had to exist, we weren't on that path in Afghanistan. So in January of last year, I deployed with about a third of my brigade combat team from 3rd Brigade, 101st Rakasans, into the East again. So the perspective is 3 combat tours. I'd been at Bagram, I'd been a battalion commander, and now a brigade commander in the East. And what I thought in 2011 was impossible. I did not think the security forces would be able to take the lead, take responsibility for their battle space, the terrain and the people and the problem sets on their own, with just us advising from behind in the offices. Last year, we didn't go in the field with them very often. We stayed at the corps level. And as Mike articulated, with the 6 corps, there's about 12,000 to 15,000 soldiers in each corps with about 4 brigades. That's about on par with the height of the surge forces the coalition had in the country in the first place. So now they own the problem. And then Kunduz happens, as General Allen mentioned. Helmand happens. These district centers start getting overrun. There's pressure from a emergent and resurgent Taliban effort in particular. And what we saw on our watch, a nascent ISIL in the Khorasan province, particularly in Nangarhar, which was a good thing, because now the Taliban and ISIL-KP are competing in open field warfare, village to village, for the same population. The people who picked up on that real quick were the Afghan National Security Forces. The comment I got from the G2, the 201st Corps, is this is the best thing that could happen to us. They realized just how bad both groups are, and we get to sit back and watch them fight. So in 11, these forces from the Afghan National Security apparatus had a problem holding checkpoints, had a problem holding district centers without U.S. or coalition effort. After these setbacks with Kunduz, with Helmand, and significant national support from the new Ghani government and a reorganization of his national security apparatus, they were able to go back in and re-siege these objectives and places that were taken with difficulty. But I looked around in the east where we were, in Kunar, in Nuristan, in Nangarhar, Paktia, and all the other provinces in the east where the terrain is contentious, the population has been compliant, and you're on the Durand line, if it actually exists, but the border sanctuary that Dr. Rydell spoke about. very contentious area. Why weren't the checkpoints being overrun? Why weren't the district centers being overrun and taken? Why wasn't large swaths of terrain being taken by the Taliban and held in perpetuity? Well, I got to go talk to one of the brigade commanders in my old base in Kunar, summer of last year. And after pleading for some assets from the coalition, particularly air power, which they are still trying to generate that kind of capability, he said, we can do it without you. We have too much ownership of this. This is our country. And regardless of what happens, we're not going to leave. So between 11, when General Allen came on board, and 15, all the Afghan National Security Forces, by presidential decree, occupied all of the coalition bases and outposts, all of them. And in our particular case, the 201st and even 203rd Corps and Gardez, they doubled down on that. They made more. For example, Pesh River Valley in Kunar, very contentious place. We came out of that valley for the most part in 2011. When the Afghan security forces took ownership of the problem, they saw a different strategy and light in there, and they built more roads. They built more combat outposts north of Wanat into the Wadapur to connect Kunar and Nuristan provinces together so the government would start having some security where it never had it before. They wanted that. We told them not to do that. From our experience, they had the initiative. They wanted that to happen. And lastly, in the East, corps get paid, and what they're for is to synchronized combined armed security effort to protect key terrain and the population, the lines of communication from Khyber Pass to Kabul, the population centers and towns and villages, and the people from having absolute chaos going on. The corps were afforded an opportunity to plan campaigns throughout the country last year, starting with Helmand, going to Kunduz, and then Ashraf Ghani looked at General Waziri at the 201st Corps on a VTC. Yes, we have them doing VTCs every week on security planning, and said, what would you like to do? And Waziri's answer was immediate. I want to go to southern Nangarhar. I want to clear terrain, and I want to make sure it's safe from the Taliban coming up from the southwest into Nangarhar, because Jalalabad has had several car bombs and had several pressures on the population. The United States did not plan this. The coalition did not plan this. This was their effort. We advised them a little bit on some operations, but they did it. They went forward with a tactical command and control element. The corps commander and a small staff forward into deep Nangarhar, set up a base, and had three brigades maneuver into the battle space that was attacked and contested by both ISIL, KP, and the Taliban. Their first operation in 48 hours, they cleared 167 IEDs by themselves with no fatalities.
This is in the spring or summer of 2015?
This is in the summer of last year. So from, again, perspective of leaving in May of 2011, when they needed us to go with them on every mission and operation just about, to Afghan security forces leading a combined arms tactical effort in the field without much coalition assistance. They were using their own D-30 howitzers, their own MD-530 aviation, and ground maneuver to include engineers, infantry, et cetera, in concert to succeed at seizing key terrain objectives away from the enemy, and then holding that terrain with additional checkpoints, with police to follow on the end, and governance at the district level to reach out to the people. That is counterinsurgency their way. And so I kind of left October of last year with, wow, we've gotten a lot further along than I would have thought possible. So again, to echo General Allen's comment, maybe pragmatic, but I would term it rationally optimistic. It's going to take an enduring effort. It's going to take international support. It's going to take commitment to keep this effort going at about these levels, and I think we'll all be surprised with what the outcome is.
And of course, it's going to take, I think, President Ghani and Chief Abdullah being willing to find, if they can, commanders of comparable ability and put them in the positions in other corps, like the one you described. So let me now, if I could, we'll do a final quick round here and then go to you. And I want to ask one question to each of our panelists. And starting with Bruce, just following up on what you said about going after the safe areas. As we all know, the safe areas are not just north and south Waziristan and, you know, this remote, rugged terrain. It's also Quetta, Peshawar, and Vonda's favorite spring break city, Karachi. And this is where people think now that Taliban leadership is located as well. Is there any way to go after them there?
There is. It's difficult. It's not easy by any means. But the May operation demonstrated that you can operate in Baluchistan, the The attack was not on the border. That was good fiction put out by the Obama administration to make it easier for the government of Pakistan to respond. It was actually quite deep inside of Baluchistan. Now, drone operations are not going to be a feasible alternative in a major urban area like Quetta, or even more so, Karachi. But the good news from the standpoint of thinking about how these safe havens and sanctuaries work is you can't run them efficiently if the leadership, the top leadership, is all the time hiding in a safe house in Quetta or Karachi. Sooner or later, they have to go out in the field. They have to go out and visit their commanders. They have to go out and see their troops. And that's when there's a level of vulnerability. Let me reiterate one point I made. We don't need the tempo of operations that CIA drones were using against al-Qaeda in 2009, 2010, and 2011. That would be an unnecessary effort. What we need is periodic, but maybe once a quarter, maybe three or four times a year, operations against senior Afghan Taliban leadership operating in these safe havens and sanctuaries to make it more difficult for them to do business as usual. If we let them operate and do business as usual as they have for the last 14 or 15 years, I don't see how this operation is ever going to tilt in the direction that we want it to tilt. There's another reason for doing this as well. General Allen mentioned the peace process and the Afghan Taliban's assessment of the peace process, and I think he got it absolutely right. The Afghan Taliban up until now has said, why should we engage in a peace process? The enemy is leaving. Sooner or later, the Americans are all going to be gone, and when they're all gone, time is going to be on our side. We have to change that calculation. I think the president's decision to leave the number of troops in was the right decision in that case. I think now showing them that the safe havens and sanctuaries are not as safe as they have been for 15 years also tips that calculation. It also helps to tip the balance of power within the Pakistani system. Pakistan is an unusual country in a lot of ways. It has a civil-military balance which is not in balance. The military runs the Afghan war. The elected civilian leadership does not run the Afghan war. We saw that in the peace process. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, I believe, was a sincere supporter of the Afghan peace process. It's pretty clear that Chief of Army Staff General Raheel Sharif was not a sincere supporter of that. And in the end, his vote mattered more than the Prime Minister's. If we change the balance of the safe haven and sanctuaries, I think we're also going to, in the long run, help the Prime Minister and the civilian government in making the case we can't go on this way. We're not going to secure victory through a military solution. We need to look for some kind of political process.
Excellent. General Allen, I wanted to ask you to pick up at that same place, if you don't mind, on the Pakistan angle, and let us know your assessment as to whether we can be successful in the absence of some fairly big shift, either in Pakistani behavior or in our ability to reach out and influence events, maybe through greater use of drone or even Afghan commando forces in Pakistan, what have you. And then secondly, because you worked with both Dr. Ghani and Dr. Abdul, I'd just be curious for your sense as to whether they're likely to make this thing work. We've seen the discussion of, and Vonda got at it earlier, of the difficulties in their relationship, the longstanding challenge of this particular government structure that's been created to paper over the differences and uncertainties of the 2014 election. Do you think these two gentlemen are likely to make it work, or do you sense that it's starting to fall apart? So both those questions, if you're willing.
Well, the frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan is really complex. When I was the commander, I thought I had a pretty good relationship with Ashfaq Ghani, who was the chief of the army staff. And I remember well the day I spent with him alone in his office over the maps in Rawalpindi, looking at the border with the intent that while I still had tens of thousands of maneuver troops, to include this great battalion commander at the time in Kunar, we had options still to run joint operations along the border in a hammer and anvil manner to achieve effect that had been achieved in previous opportunities. I woke up the next morning, roughly the 25th or so of November 2011, and one of my special operations units had basically devastated two Pakistani border posts. That did two things. It shut down the relationship with Pakistan for the ISAF commander. It also shut down the ground line of communications over which 80% of my support came. We never, during the period of time I commanded in Afghanistan, we never had the opportunity to achieve the potential energy of combined operations along that border that could have made the difference that we had hoped to, a difference with the Afghan Taliban in Afghanistan and us assisting the Pakistanis to deal with their own Afghan or their own Taliban problem in north and south Waziristan and down in Balochistan. So we did not have that opportunity. But we did have something, and we haven't addressed it yet this morning, which I think more needs to be done, and then it bleeds over into the issue of leadership. We did have something called the Trilateral Commission, where periodically I, and until the Pakistan went silent after this crisis and then came back up online later in my command, where I and the Chief of Staff of the Afghan National Security Forces and the Chief of the Army Staff would meet for a day periodically, and our subordinate leaders at key locations and key ranks and key functions would all meet together. And the intent was, as I said in my first meeting with the three of them, my hope is, and Colonel Val said it very well a moment ago, my hope is, my great ambition is that at some point there will only be two chairs at this table. In other words, we can create the environment of cooperation, the environment of relationships between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where eventually, as we will do what will happen, which is to go to a very small number or go to a zero balance, the relationship is sufficiently robust, not just at a governmental level, but at a security level, so that Pakistan and Afghanistan can both sustain the security of their frontier. That was not to happen during my command for a whole variety of reasons, and I wish we had, because I had the maneuver forces, I think, to do that. That aspect is absent today in the relationship. And yes, we go through the motions of Afghanistan attempting to have a relationship with Pakistan, with the Chief of Staff of the Afghan Army attempting to have a conversation with Rahil Sharif, but it is not where it would have been had we been able to cultivate it from 12, 13, and 14 on. And it will only come eventually. We will only control that border. We will only provide for the security as we need to in the eastern sectors of Afghanistan and in the federally administered tribal areas and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. It will only occur if we are able to create a viable relationship between the Afghan National Security Forces and their counterpart Pakistani forces across the border. I do agree exactly or entirely with Bruce. As we began the process of continuing to first stabilize our presence, to increase our support to the Afghans, conceivably with the new president doing even more to improve the combination of the NATO forces with the NATO Secretary General, having a relationship with the Pakistani military and being able to strike those Taliban leadership, both TTP, Tariq-e-Taliban Pakistan, and also the Afghan Pakistan, to be able to strike on both sides of the border with precision will help us, I think, a great deal. With respect to the current configuration in Afghanistan, I think we are stumbling along, and I just don't see over the long period of time under a presidential system that we can have a relationship between a president and a chief executive officer. It was a Band-Aid to keep the outcome of the election several years ago from tearing the country apart. I think Vanda is exactly correct. We may now begin to, we may be seeing now the beginning of the cracks in that process that will either, if we don't pay close attention to it and we don't do something to try to reinforce either the current organization or shift it from the presidential system that it is today to the parliamentary system, we're liable to see those cracks widen. In fact, we could see open conflict. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're at that dire point. But I think there are indicators that would point to the fact that we're going to have to see some form of political evolution, because this was an interim solution. It was never intended to be a permanent solution. And this kind of an interim solution under constant pressure, in particular under increasing pressure from the Taliban, make it difficult to govern the country, make it difficult to get the economy on its feet, and certainly makes it difficult to command and control an Afghan National Security Force, which is still being trained, still being brought up to full operational capability, but under full pressure at the same time. It's a very difficult situation, and it is not optimal. It is not, was not intended to be permanent, and we need to look to getting to a permanent outcome.
Thank you. And so, Vonda, anything you want to add on all these subjects, but specifically the last question I have before we go to the audience would be your views of the state of the economy, which is obviously not great, but also the production of opium, which is obviously not a great situation either. But is there anything useful besides dealing with these broader security and political questions that we can do to help the Afghans mitigate the difficult situation in the economics and drug production realms?
I'll come to that question, but let me start by saying that this moment in Afghanistan and, of course, the opportunity with the U.S. elections and new president is a time to perhaps ask again to what extent the effort in Afghanistan is about a military effort to break, defeat an enemy, and to what extent it's about a political process and political evolution in the country. I strongly believe that it is the latter, and that inevitably, even any conceivable increase in U.S. military engagement in Afghanistan in the next year will not be sufficient to operate on the basis that this war can be about simply wiping out the Taliban. That requires very hard prioritization of how U.S. forces are engaged, but it also very much drives engaging in Afghanistan through the prism of politics and governance. And the Afghans themselves need to come to that understanding and embrace it. So when Afghan security forces say it's okay if the Taliban and ISIS as Khorasan are killing each other, and we just sit back and watch, that has profound political implications. When that happened in Nangarhar, it fundamentally discredited Kabul government, and it discredited already very contestable government in Jalalabad. And ultimately, the Afghan government was not able to stay by the determination we just watched the fighting take place. A key problem for the Afghan government has been for the entire decade and a half and continues to be today, governance delivered in local areas. And so for many Afghans, the Taliban is a brutal, thuggish entity, but nonetheless, they provide more stable, predictable, and culpable governance than governance that is either constantly contestable between militant groups, governance that is weak, where the ASF clears and hands it over to the ALP and they cannot hold, or governance that is outright pernicious and discriminatory. Let's remember that Kunduz fell and was in the making of falling because for a decade and a half, it was one of the most politically problematic, vicious, infighting place in Afghanistan. And that has not been resolved after the city, and just the city, has been taken away from the Taliban. The issue of Pakistan is very important, but it is always used as an excuse by Afghans not to focus on improving politics and governance. They need to increase, they need to improve themselves. The convenient distraction of both sides for perpetuating policies that are bad. Targeting also needs to become political. While it makes perfectly good sense to try to take away the sense of safety, as Bruce phrased it, from the Taliban in Pakistan, we need to be asking about the political implications of that. And ask about if we kill this Taliban commander, whether it is on the Afghan side or on the Pakistani side, what are the political repercussions within the movement? Is it going to give rise to a more vicious element within the Taliban? I wrote a piece in New York Times after the killing of Mansoor raising some of these questions. So my bottom line is that although security impinges and overlaps everything, Security is political. It is linked to politics. And our thinking about strategy in Afghanistan and Afghan thinking needs to be about politics and governance. To finally come back to your question on economy. The economy is in a difficult shape. It was bound to be, and it is. The growth is around 2%. That's vastly inadequate for a country of the level of underdevelopment problems and poverty that that Afghanistan faces. It might be what Japan and other countries would love to have, but this is not what's sufficient for Afghanistan. There's been massive economic shrinkage and contraction, and there is simply no way out of it. Sadly, that's one of the reasons why your retention, or rather why recruitment for the ANSF continues to be high, offsetting the vast retention losses, because there are simply no other jobs. There's some good news, namely that the finance ministry managed to raise the levels of custom and tax revenues, very important economically, but also very important politically, sending some signal that there is not complete impunity, that not everything can simply be stolen out of the country, and hopefully that trend will continue. But there is no easy way to break from the job shortage and from the essentially economic stagnation that we are seeing. And that also generates then pressures of refugees, some of whom go to Europe, or at least we have been trying, others who have been fighting under Iran sponsorship in Syria. But this is sort of the level of options that people face. Equally, there is... There are very limited options as to what can be done about Poppy. There are a lot of very bad and disastrous options, namely to try to ramp up some eradication of Poppy crops. It is a caricature to say that Poppy is about the Taliban. Yes, the Taliban makes money on Poppy, but so do very many other actors, including actors crucial linked to politics. And it's not surprising. This is the economic lifeline of the country. Inevitably, if anyone wants to have minimal political support, they will need to, at minimum, sponsor, likely more deeply engage with the opium poppy economy. There are two elements of policies that are available in the current context of security. One is to think, again, politically, about interdiction targeting, and think about who are the dangerous actors, and not just on Taliban side, that should not have access to the poppy economy. That doesn't mean that there will be any less opium, poppy, and heroin production in the country, but it's about who should have access, or rather who absolutely shouldn't have access, and who is less dangerous in having access. And again, this is not the holders and stakeholders are not just the Taliban. There are a whole variety of political actors who might be become problematic, whose opium poppy stocks could go up in flames. And so the interdiction should really be about reinforcing the stability of a Kabul government rather than operating on the delusions that it can alter flows and financing. The other crucial element, and one where the international community and the Afghan government have objectively failed and did not have to, is to start seriously boosting treatment options for Afghans. Addiction, abuse, communicable diseases related to injectable heroin have vastly increased in Afghanistan, and yet there are some 42, perhaps, treatment centers of very inadequate very inadequate level. There is much more very simple steps that can be done on prevention as well as more robust treatment options.
Thank you very much. Great. So we have about 25 minutes. Because we don't have too much time, we have a lot of you and a lot of expertise in the room. I'm going to take three questions at a time, ask my colleagues to take good notes, and maybe just choose one question each to answer from each round. And so please remember to identify yourself and ask just one question apiece. We'll start here with the woman in the second row, then over to Harlan, and then the woman in the fourth row for round one.
Thank you so much. My name is Nazira Azim Karimi. I'm correspondent for Aryana Television Network from Afghanistan, and I'm from Afghanistan too. First of all, thank you so much, General Allen. for your hard job in Afghanistan. The time that you've been in Afghanistan was very sensitive and tough time.
Thank you.
As you know, the Pakistan policy never gets changed toward Afghanistan. And Afghan people have a high expectation from the U.S. authority. Based off your opinion, what policy United States supposed to take to Pakistan change their policy toward Afghanistan? And also, based off the situation in Afghanistan, what is your expectation from the upcoming Brussels conference?
Thank you. And then over to Harlan right here.
I'm Harlan Ullman. Thanks for a very thoughtful discussion. As people do not remember, we've been engaged in Afghanistan since 1980 when Jimmy Carter issued a finding. I'd like to ask the panel the question that John Allen's former boss, Dave Petraeus, famously asked. Tell me how this ends. President Donald Trump, listening to one of his key military advisors, I use that phrase loosely, has said he's getting out of Afghanistan if he's elected. President Hillary Clinton, according to one of her senior advisors, said she's going to double down and put more forces into Afghanistan. Tell me what's right and wrong with both positions.
Okay, and then we'll go here in the fourth row.
Hi, good morning. I'm Miranda Cleland. I go to American University. I also work for an Afghan nonprofit, Mike Hasina Sherjan, sends her regards.
Thank you.
I have a question regarding opium. So UNODC's 2015 opium survey reports that net opium poppy cultivation is down by 19%. That's the first decline since 2009. Mm-hmm. And potential production of opium is down by 48%. What do you think caused such a decline? And what factors do you think threaten the progress of ending Afghanistan's largely opium-based economy?
Why don't we start with that one and Vonda, if we could, and then we'll see how we go from there.
Well, there's absolutely no short-term frame in which Afghanistan's opium poppy economy could end. So if our goal or baseline is when we will end it, we will be bitterly disappointed, as we have been many times over the past decade. There is only one country that, there are several countries that successfully ended opium poppy cultivation. One of them is Thailand. There it took 30 years. The maximum production was 19,000 hectares, and the war had ended. In all the other countries which succeeded in eliminating opium poppy cultivation, only to shift it to another country, conflict had ended. As long as conflict is on, there will be opium poppy. Opium production went down by 19% does not mean very much. A lot of it has been fluctuating up and down, largely irrespective of policy, driven by factors such as overproduction, disease, bad weather. The market is still vastly oversupplied by the level of production. The much more important and significant number that I would seek to look at is the extent of microeconomic dependence on opium poppy production as well as macroeconomic dependence. And those numbers have not budged. We can discuss offline the way UN measures and what are the problems with that. I would just suggest that it's far more than the farm gate or even border value. What really matters is the economic spillover issues. There are places in Afghanistan where opium poppy does not have to be, where there are other viable alternatives. Some of those have returned to opium poppy as a result of insecurity. Others have returned to opium poppy because people are trying to generate assets that can be sold quickly because they don't trust the financial system. Opium poppy, or rather opium or heroin, are better assets. And a lot of the entrenchment is driven by insecurity. And just to answer Harlan's question, the fundamental question, how does it end? At the risk of sounding funny, I'll go back to what I said before. It will have to end through political process. I don't believe that it can end through simply eliminating or wiping out the Taliban. And I say that even as I believe that the Taliban is increasingly making mistakes, partially because of their expectation that the momentum is on their side, they are treating a lot of their soldiers very much as cannon fodder. even missions that are not outright suicide missions are missions in which vast number of their soldiers will not come back. And so there is a real limit to that policy. And I think there is a significant possibility that one slow end, but very, very slow end, is one where we hold long enough and the Afghan government hold long enough until the Taliban does itself in from its own mistakes. But it's a very chancy policy. And to run a country, or for that matter, your foreign policy toward a country, on hoping that your enemy will make enough mistakes is a risky proposition. The only other way that it can end is through political process. And I don't mean by that simply negotiations with the Taliban, which is elusive and remote and nowhere going to come online in any serious matter for a long time. But it's about politics within Afghanistan. It's about the ending the constant brinksmanship, one for all, let's just make most money and most power before it all falls down. And unless that mentality changes, no matter what we do with Pakistan and no matter what we do with the Taliban, and as long as governance continues to be pernicious from the perspective of Afghan people, the conflict will not end.
Thank you. John.
I think, Bruce, you want to touch the Pakistan question?
Sure. Please. Pakistan is, as almost every issue, a very complex, very complicated place. Pakistani policy towards Afghanistan has multiple layers. The individual actors involved in Pakistan's policy towards Afghanistan have complicated layers. First, in trying to get at that, I want to compliment Harlan. I've been looking for months to find out what Mr. Trump's posture is on Afghanistan. I hadn't been aware that he had indicated that the U.S. was going to pull out. I thought a Trump policy on Afghanistan was to make Afghanistan great again by building a large wall on its southern border. Now I've found out that that's not indeed the case. I agree with Vanda. Politics is how this ends. Politics inside Afghanistan, politics between Afghanistan and Pakistan, politics between the United States and Pakistan, and regional politics more broadly. One of the flaws of the so-called AFPAC strategy back in 2009 was it wasn't a South Asian strategy. We didn't try to incorporate the views of India. We didn't try to incorporate the views of Iran. We didn't try to incorporate the views of Central Asia in any serious way. A new American strategy needs to do all of those things. I laid out some of the specifics I think we need to do about Pakistan. I think we need to be willing to engage in more drone operations like the Mullah Mansur, not many of them, but some. We need to be much more decisive in trying to go after Afghan funding, and a lot of that goes through Pakistan at the end of the day. At the same time, we have to robustly engage the Pakistanis, and that includes both the political leadership and the military leadership. I would hope that whoever is next president of the United States would early on invite Nawaz Sharif to come to the United States for serious discussions, a state visit. I would hope that the next president of the United States will travel to Pakistan on his or her watch and engage with the Pakistanis there. When she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton went to Pakistan on numerous occasions. She was very blunt in what she had to say. She repeatedly said that, in her opinion, somebody in the Pakistani establishment knew exactly where Osama bin Laden was living, and I think in retrospect she turns out to have been very prescient on that. I think we also have to realize, though, that the next administration is not going to have some of the options that the Obama administration had. You know, in the first 2 weeks of President Obama's coming into office, he sent somewhere in excess of 20,000 troops into Afghanistan. I think that's almost inconceivable that the next president would be able to do that. Almost. Caveat is there because Trump has proven to be unpredictable in so many ways. Who knows? He might even be able to pull off something like that. I think it'd be very hard for Mrs. Clinton to pull off something like that. Her own political party, the press in this country would not be willing to go along. That option, I think, is pretty much off the table. I think you could make changes in the composition of American forces. You can change mission requirements. You could probably increase 1,000 or 2,000, but you're not going to be able to send 20,000, let alone have a surge of the magnitude that President Obama had, unless situation deteriorates remarkably. something else the next president is not going to be able to do, and that is substantial economic and military assistance to Pakistan. When President Obama came into office, he was an enthusiastic supporter of the increasing economic assistance to Pakistan, and we saw a substantial increase in economic assistance. President Bush and President Obama, over the course of the last 15 years, have provided Pakistan with in excess of $25 billion in military and economic assistance. You could not get that through the Hill. It just is impossible today. The mood on the Hill about Pakistan has changed dramatically in the last 2 years, and it's changed against providing assistance to Pakistan. So that option will be off the table. You may be able to get some increases in aids in the economic field. I don't think you're going to be able to do it in any significant way. I think it would be very hard to persuade this Congress to provide substantial military assistance, military sales, or anything in that order. So I think it's going to be a complicated action. I think we need to be, as I said earlier, willing to be on the offense. I think at the same time we're going to have to engage very, very hard with the Pakistani leadership, and that's going to be a difficult and complicated conversation.
Thank you. And I'll just follow in behind both comments. I couldn't agree more with both Vanda and Bruce that the solution is a political solution, and never were our recommendations with respect to the residual NATO force intended to give the Afghans the capacity to wipe out the Taliban. Our hope had been to give the Afghan National Security Forces, the Army in particular, but in particular as well as the police, to give them the capacity to control the Taliban, to render their operational threat, their potential existential threat to the country, to render that to a level where it could be handled over a long period of time by the standing Afghan forces. And I believe, as Colonel Vowell saw personally, that with the right configuration of allied capabilities, NATO capabilities, for the right period of time and the right resources to the Afghan National Security Forces, I believe that security platform can be sustained, upon which then, as Vanda correctly has pointed out, the political stability can move forward. The security platform is irrelevant, except insofar as it creates the environment within Afghanistan writ large where political progress and stability can move forward and where economic stability and economic progress can also take hold. Those other two legs of that stool can only flourish if we have a security stability, that can only be sustained, I believe, by a long-term NATO presence in that country, long-term, well beyond 2020, a long-term sustainability to the Afghan National Security Forces, well beyond 2020. As Colonel Vowell said, and I think many of us in here recognize, we didn't get to the point where the armed forces of the Republic of Korea or the Japanese forces or the Taiwan forces or the Thai forces or the Philippine forces or the Colombian forces were able to achieve the level of stability or level of capabilities that they could have by being there for 3 years with numbers that were irrelevant. The only way we're going to do this with Afghanistan is to be there in numbers that are relevant, with capabilities that are relevant for the period of time that gives us the capacity to trice them up while they're building their own capabilities to build that security platform for political stability and economic progress. And I don't know what that number is. I gave a number a few years ago, my suggestion would be that the next president, as I said before, take the time to do the kind of analysis that is necessary to look at the situation within the government and the economy and the security platform so all three of those are looked at holistically, and that we can take the steps that are necessary to put in several thousand more if necessary, or to change the combination of forces that are necessary ultimately to achieve that stability. With regard to Pakistan, I used to get the CODELs that would come through, congressional delegations that would come through my headquarters in Afghanistan, in Kabul. And it seemed to me that, taking an implication from Bruce's comments, it seemed to me that invariably, after they would get the brief from me, the intent was to go then to Islamabad and give them a piece of their mind, or move into the normal American punitive reflex with respect to Pakistan. And I reject that, and I always advised against it, because we needed to engage with Pakistan. It needed to not be a punitive relationship. because there's just so far we could push them before something may ultimately happen that we could lose control of. And frankly, I don't know that the Pakistanis even know how far that could go. There have been helpful political developments and political progress. We have seen the peaceful change of one civilian government to another. But we've not seen the kind of military capabilities brought to bear in the Fatah that are necessary. But to be fair, the Pakistani military, of course, maintains a large component of its strength in the east and a lesser and an expeditionary component of its strength in the west. And that portion of its strength in the west is generally not well resourced, and they live in difficult circumstances. They fight in difficult circumstances, and in many respects, those troops are Punjabi, and in many respects are viewed as a foreign occupying power as much as we would be if we were there. So it's a really difficult situation, as Bruce implies. Where I think we can make the greatest contribution is to try to, with the international community, facilitate the kind of dialogue and conversation between Afghanistan and Pakistan that can move us in a direction where they can have the relationship necessary to get a relatively effective peace process going. And then I'll stop there.
Thank you. We have time for one final lightning round. We're going to take two quick questions, three quick responses, and we'll be done. So let's see. Maybe I'll take three questions. So the two gentlemen right next to each other here in about the seventh row or sixth row, and then the woman over here in the fifth row. Then we'll wrap up.
Tom Olson. A question about the funding from Middle Eastern countries, from the Gulf countries. How significant is it? Who's doing it? Do we know who's doing it? And what is their motivation?
Thank you very much, Michael. I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with the Pakistan American League. As Vonda mentioned, that in Afghanistan, corruption, bad governance, rule of law, and when anything goes wrong there, they fix the blame on Pakistan. And for General Allen, I have this question that in spite of having communication lines open in 2011, why those special forces really destroyed not only a checkpost, but killed 27 people, including the commanding officer of that post. And about Bruce, I will say he has mentioned about fixing the blame on Pakistan that they finance the Taliban in Afghanistan. Could he tell us what is the incentive of Pakistan to finance those Talibans? And
thank you. Lightning round rules. That's it.
Under the leadership of USA, I think there should be a regional approach, and all the stakeholders should be included in that negotiation.
Thank you. And then over here for the last question, please.
Hi, I'm Masuda Sultan. I'm a founding board member of the largest women's organization in Afghanistan called Women for Afghan Women. I've also been running a business and I've been serving as a DOD contractor supporting the ANSF. My question is, there seems to be agreement that there's a political solution needs to happen. There's a large dissatisfaction with the National Unity Government, and there's talks of Valoria Jirga and possibly new elections. This is mostly what I've heard from my Afghan colleagues. They've said that if there were Valoria Jirga today, they may scrap the NUG entirely, form an interim government, or call for new elections. And I just wanted to see your thoughts on that, what you thought, you know, assuming that the NUG is not working, what other solutions might work politically, and whether the U.S., you know, what the Afghans say is if the U.S. leaves us alone, then we will create a new government. A new government. But if the U.S. Insists on an NUG-type government, then that will continue. So I just want to get your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Vonda, do you want to start with that last question again, and then we'll work down?
Sure. One of the misperceptions and common myths repeated in Afghanistan is that the National Unity Government was foistered on Afghanistan by the United States. Let's remember that there were months prior of Afghan inability to resolve highly contentious presidential elections, and that by the time the United States was engaging with Afghan politicians on how to end the crisis, the country might have been on the verge of ethnic strike with strife, with forces mobilizing in ethnic forces mobilizing around Kabul. There was also talk of a military coup. And so far, one of the governance advantages that Afghanistan has had over Pakistan, which is equally characterized by miserable governance, corruption, problematic politicians, is also that in Pakistan there are military coups, whereas fortunately in Afghanistan we haven't had one. And should we come to that in Afghanistan, there is a high chance that the military will fall apart along ethnic and patronage lines, effectively ending our ability to maintain the current level of counterinsurgency. It is up to the Afghan politicians, and not just President Ghani and CEO Abdullah Abdullah, but a whole variety of key other power brokers, to resolve what to do about the national unity government. Calls for early elections are just infeasible. There is no security put in progress for that. And the electoral issues that have prevented district and parliamentary elections from being held will not be magically erased for a new presidential elections. So calls for that are calls that fuel political tensions, but really are not realistic. So there will have to be some sort of negotiations between the key actors. A constitutional jirga cannot be constitutionally held because district and parliamentary elections, which would be feeding some of the delegates, will not have taken place. A loyal jirga, which is what former President Karzai has called for, will lack credibility. Who will it be stuffed with, and with what kind of agenda? There is nothing inevitable that the government needs to stay in its current configuration. There is, however, also nothing inevitable that it needs to be renegotiated. What is crucial needed is for Afghan politicians to recognize how precarious state their country is, and instead of just engaging in infighting, agree to support a government whose purpose will be to deliver better governance and increase security. That can be with the current constellation, or it can be with another one. Afghans often say that they don't want the U.S. to be involved with that, and yet they all the time, many politicians run to the U.S. then to negotiate and adjudicate among the sandbox fights that are taking place. And the U.S. is a very difficult position. In my view, the U.S. should be less engaged in holding the Afghans by hand. At the same time, I say it, having previously called for that the most crucial and yet most difficult element is precisely managing the political processes and the many pernicious political processes. I also want to just end on, although I say that Afghans often use Pakistan as an excuse, Pakistanis often use Afghanistan as an excuse, and the country is equally troubled by poor governance and very nefarious external policies that sponsor the Taliban.
Thank you. General John.
Just a couple of brief comments. Vanda has hit a couple of this has hit this a couple of times, and I've meant to comment on it. When I came back from Afghanistan and I did my final briefs around Washington, I talked about what I believe to be the future of Afghanistan, and I said that I believed that with the right combination of sustained support by NATO, the ANSF could, over time, be able to take care of themselves, to deal with the threat of the Taliban. And I believed it then, and I believe it now, and I think the next president has the opportunity to perhaps improve on that. I also said that I believe that with the continued sustainment of the Afghan National Security Forces, that we could handle the safe havens in Pakistan. Now, they would be a challenge. They would always be a means by which the Taliban could replenish themselves and refurbish their capabilities. But I believe that over time, with the right kind of NATO presence to deal with the Taliban in the country, particularly in the east, in 201, 203rd Corps area, with the defense in depth that we were putting in place, that, in fact, the Afghans could handle the security situation and deal with the safe havens in Pakistan. But I then said, and I was very clear about this, I believe that the existential threat to Afghanistan is not the Taliban, and it is not Pakistan. The existential threat to Afghanistan is corruption. And until Afghans are willing, ultimately, as Vanda has said, to shed their self-interest, until we're able to deal with the criminal capture of institutions, both at the national level and very importantly, which makes progress very difficult, at the sub-national level, provincial and district, until we're able to deal with the pernicious nature of corruption, which is both corrosive of democracy, but also an impediment to building real capabilities and capacity within the institutions of government, Afghanistan is going to be stuck where it is today, which I think it still is on the poverty scale of the fourth poorest country in the world, maybe the third or fourth at this point, but also in terms of corruption, it ranks slightly above Somalia and North Korea. And so if we are ever to see real progress in Afghanistan, it has got to be at the point where ultimately the institutions of Pakistan can be wrested from the criminal capture of organized crime and the unwillingness of Afghans to do the right thing for each other and for their country. And then finally, on the issue of Middle East funding, I spent a lot of time with our intelligence services, and Bruce may have a similar view or a different view, trying to pinpoint the exact origins of funding for the Taliban. It's very difficult to do it. Large amounts of money come out of the Gulf. I don't believe it is state-sponsored. I didn't believe it when I was the commander, and since I've had the opportunity to spend some time in a couple of different billets where I had to deal with it, and I don't believe it is state-sponsored. But I do believe there are key individuals in the Gulf that are providing funding. And in order to solve that, it's both about getting after the financial system that makes it difficult for that to occur, but also cooperating with the national governments in the Gulf, the monarchies in the Gulf, to put pressure on those individuals who might be doing it. I watched with great interest in the summer of 12 as Syria exploded as a civil war, and I watched the funding be diverted from the Gulf into Syria, and the funding levels for the Taliban plummeted. It became very difficult in the summer of 12 for the Taliban to field the kinds of IEDs, RPGs, et cetera, and it actually changed the operational balance. So it is not insignificant, the funding that is going into the Gulf. And with regard to the border incident, I'll have to talk to you separately. I've got my views, very strong views. It was an unfortunate incident. We expressed our regret. I still am in prayer over the lives of the lost Pakistani military troops. But the shooting didn't start on our side. I'll just tell you that. I'll get that out since you chose to make your comments as well. It didn't start on our side, but sadly it got beyond both sides. And it was a matter of trust on both sides. Had we had better trust, had we been better organized in our joint border coordination centers, we probably could have solved it before the really heavy shooting started, and we would have prevented the outcome that we ultimately had, which, for all intents and purposes, lost us 9 months of cooperation with Pakistan, which could have been quite valuable to the progress of the war. And we still regret those losses by the Pakistani military.
Thank you. Bruce, final word.
I'll be brief. I'll make 2 points. First point, the next president of the United States inherits the longest war in American history. In these upcoming debates, both the presidential and vice presidential, it is really incumbent on these two people to tell us what they're going to do about this war. We need something serious, a real debate about what the United States is going to do in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The issue remains very serious for many, many reasons that you've already heard. I'll just add one more. While al-Qaeda has been disrupted and dismantled significantly in Pakistan in the last 7 years, the one fact we know about al-Qaeda is its resiliency. And if we take off the pressure on al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and especially in Pakistan, you will see that resiliency once again. Second point is about funding. I think General Allen has addressed that issue very carefully and I think correctly. It's a murky area, but a substantial amount of Taliban funding comes from rich private donors in the Gulf states. It's no accident that Mullah Mansour spent 18 trips to Dubai because Dubai is one of the least governed spaces in the Gulf states. The United Arab Emirates is supposed to be a single country. Anyone who's ever visited the United Arab Emirates knows there's 7 countries, and Dubai has very difficult relations in many ways with Abu Dhabi. we need to put considerable effort into working with the governments of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and others, in order to persuade them to take the kind of aggressive actions against funding for the Afghan Taliban that they have already taken against funding for Al-Qaeda and for the Islamic State.
Thank you very much. In closing, let me just say that in addition to what you have heard today, we are producing this paper that General Allen referred to earlier with a lot of the former commanders, the SRAPs, the ambassadors, a number of us in the scholarly ranks that we hope will be of use to the next president as well. That'll be coming out, I hope, later this month. But let me just thank all of you for being here. Please join me in thanking the panel.